Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the managing director of Atom Ventures and Atom CTO. And today I'm here with Guy Bevington from True North. Say hello, Guy.
Hey, how you doing?
Right. So this is a podcast I've been wanting to do for quite a while, actually, because it's about recruitment. It's that dreaded word, recruitment. And I think over the years, I think I was one of those people very early on, very much against using recruiters to hire new techies. And over the years, I realized that that was a very, very silly kind of viewpoint to take. And I'm now converted into totally the other world. But I find that a lot of the clients I work with are in that mindset that recruiters are the bad people. So what I'd like to do is, in a sense, demystify the world of recruitment, and especially in the world of tech recruitment and recruiting techies. So before we get into that, can we start with a little bit about your background? Because you started True North during the pandemic. So can you just start a little bit about, can you just talk a little bit about yourself and how you came to start True North?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background, in a nutshell, without boring you to death, was essentially 13 years in the recruitment industry now to date. So started off very green, no prior experience to recruitment. Didn't really know what it was, truth be told. Just one of my best mates said, you should have a look at recruitment. It's a very people orientated industry. You can make good money, which as a young man of 23, 24 was kind of ticking all the right boxes. And to a more or less a degree, in the first few years of my career, I really enjoyed it. I was very happy. I was prepared to, kind of do very long hours, 12, 13 hour days. I was enjoying the city life, being a bit of a country bumpkin from the Midlands. So it really did tick a lot of the right boxes for me. But, I think your point there you made about, recruitment seen as the bad guys, I think is a very apt one. And unfortunately, I got to the place really after about a 10-year stint in the industry where I was in a very, very bad way with it, to be honest. I was very disenchanted with the industry. I felt that recruitment was fundamentally broken. And I just wasn't really enjoying it. So I was actually prepared to almost walk away from recruitment altogether. And then I sort of took a bit of time out because I spent sort of best part of 10 years at one company, and I hadn't really had much of a break, longer than, I think 2 weeks was the longest break I had in the whole 10-year period. I hadn't really had a break. I was, just mentally, physically exhausted, and I just needed some time out, really. So after a bit of R&R and evaluating different career options and, thinking what I might do, I actually sort of, opened the lid back upon recruitment and thought, okay, well, look, without blowing smoke at my own derriere, I was pretty good at it. Yeah. I'm hopefully pretty good at it. And there were lots of really good things about the job that I really enjoyed, both from a job fulfillment point of view and actually, the big impact on people's lives. I always say you've got the three big decisions in life. You've got who you love, a house you buy, and the job you do. And fundamentally, we're helping people genuinely make one of those really big decisions. So there were loads of parts of the job that actually, in retrospect, looking back, when I was sort of outside the pressure cooker environment, I actually enjoyed. And then I kind of came full circle and thought, well, look, why don't I just do recruitment in the way I think it should be done, the way I enjoy doing it, and the way I feel is sustainable and is able to, allow others to enjoy doing the job as well. So I decided to start True North. And essentially, the concept, I guess, of the business sounds really cheesy, but it is genuinely very true, and it's what gets me out of bed every morning. The concept is to create a business that helps people be happy at work, and that's both internally and externally, because I think the world of work for a lot of people is a place full of fear, anxiety, misery, and people. I don't believe it has to be that way. That's the thing that really drives us. It's about putting people into the right role that's right for them, and serving others, rather than serving yourself, which unfortunately is where I think a lot of recruitment companies probably get this very bad rep that you've spoken about, because they're just very sort of focused on billing, making money, no element of customer service or actually caring about the person you're dealing with. And it's just these sort of pressure cooker environments where people are being pit against each other. And it's just, very, very self-serving. And that's kind of everything that I wanted to get away from. And I feel we have, obviously a long way to go, but successfully done that, I guess.
So I guess one of the main objections that people have to recruitment is the cost, right? So obviously, if you're hiring people at a high wage, especially in the tech industry, there's a significant portion of that wage would go to a recruiter. And I think a lot of people then look at that and say, well, I could do it myself. So from your perspective, what value do you bring, say, as True North or as any kind of recruitment consultant? What value do you bring? Why is that a poor argument, the cost savings piece?
I don't think it is necessarily a poor argument. I mean, I always say to clients, you know, I'm a realist. I think if you can find people directly in your network, do it, because it's going to save you money at the end of the day. You know, don't pay a recruiter X amount of thousands of pounds if you can go and find these people easily. But we exist as a service when that's not always possible. And there's a big difference between cost and value, I guess, right? You could look at it and go, right, well, this is going to cost us X amount of thousands of pounds to go and hire this person. But what is the value of your time? Because fundamentally, that's our service. That's what we do, is we save time. You know, yes, we supply CVs. Yes, we, you know, build relationships with candidates to deliver them to companies. But ultimately, our service to candidates and to clients really is to save them their precious time. And, you know, if a role has been open for 6 months and, you know, the company's been looking directly to market, trying to find this person for 6 months because they're trying to avoid paying a recruitment fee, what's the opportunity cost on that 6 months of actually what you've lost? You know, I'm sure the outcome of that situation is usually far in advance of the initial kind of fee investment in the first place. So it's always that cost balance, you know, value balance for companies. But ultimately, you know, as I say, we're here to all intents and purposes to allow people to get on with their actual job, you know, which is you know, probably not recruitment. And the analogy I always use is, you know, I could go and walk up and down the street to go and find my new house that I want to live in, but it's not particularly cost effective way of me finding my next house to live in. What I'd probably rather do is go to an estate agent and, you know, and get them to effectively deliver for me a service. So yeah, that's what I would say to that.
So I've got two questions rolled into one here, really. Where, the first part of that question is, who do you see that you're bringing the most value to? Is it the candidates? Is it the customers? Is it both? Which I'm going to guess you're going to say both. But the second part of that question is, so how are you building that value, right? So what goes on the day, what goes on in the day in the life of a recruitment consultant?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of who you're serving, I mean, it's a dual service role. You've obviously got two customer bases. You've got the candidates, you've got clients, and you're the kind of conduit, you know, kind of magnet, I guess, that sits in the middle of the two. Obviously, our service to a candidate doesn't cost anything, right? Our service is free. So at the end of the day, I guess to a more or lesser degree, our income stream always comes from the client. So of course, we have to make sure our clients are happy with us, because quite frankly, from a business point of view, if they're not, we're not going to be making placements, and obviously then we're not going to make any money. So from that regard, you know, of course, clients will always be have to be looked after. But ironically, to keep clients happy, you need to have the strong relationships with candidates to be able to deliver those candidates to those clients. So we really don't favor one above the other. We don't see sort of clients up here on this pedestal and candidates down here, because there's many very, very candidates driven markets where, you know, you think about what's actually the commodity in the market. It's not the job. It's not the company. And those companies that kind of actually are genuinely quite successful at securing the best talent, and no doubt we'll probably go on to talking about interview processes and the recruitment processes later on, but those companies actually are better at securing talent are the ones that recognize that, you know, they're not necessarily everybody should want to come and work for me kind of mentality. It's actually recognizing this is a candidate strapped market, and we've got to be really intelligent with how we go about securing these people. So yeah, I guess we do see it pretty much as a 50-50 weighting in terms of you know, how we value those relationships for those reasons. But in terms of the value of, you know, how we bring value to the table, I guess, I mean, it's, you've got two types of recruitment, I guess. You've got generalist recruiters, and then you've got specialist niche recruiters. And then you've got all these sort of, you know, sexy titles like headhunters and executive search and stuff. But it's the same thing. You know, it's just rebadged, essentially. And, you know, all these people that call themselves exec search just means that they, you know, they recruit people at a slightly higher level salary. It's the same concepts really that required around basic human psychology. So, yeah, I guess we very much aligned with the vertical market specialism, that sort of super niche model, because we believe that, you know, in life you should do one thing and do it very, very well. You know, there's a reason that Apple don't make Hoovers. You know, they kind of know what they're good at, and they don't try and be good at absolutely everything. And I think businesses that generally succeed are those that kind of know what they're good at and sort of focus on that one area. So we are pretty much primarily tech, but every single consultant in the business focuses on very own defined vertical market. So we'd have somebody doing, you know, full stack JavaScript engineers, somebody else doing machine learning engineers, you know, so on and so forth. And the idea behind that being that you do truly build a community in one particular area. Because if you were to distill recruitment down to into one word, it's relationships, you know, and if you don't have those relationships, you're not going to be successful. It's kind of as simple as that, you know. And the thing that separates, you know, a generalist recruiter to a specialist recruiter is a generalist recruiter, every single time they get a job, you know, because they could be working a Java engineer one day, CTO the next day, admin support person the next day. Every single time they get a job, they're starting that search from scratch. You know, there's no momentum, there's no value in their business really, other than their ability to go to market and try and find a few candidates on a fluky off chance. Whereas the whole model that we live and breathe is people often think in recruitment it's about the number of people you know. I don't agree with that. It's, you don't need to know everybody in your market at all. I think you need to know the good people very well. And I think it's about the strength of your relationship with a select number of very good candidates, rather than knowing every single candidate in the market. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of work that it takes to get to that position. You know, a lot of kissing of frogs and meeting various people to, you know, to really define the sort of cream of the crop in your marketplace. But ultimately, that's what a client's paying for when they're coming to us to pay us a fee. They're paying for our opinion. You know, they're paying for our due diligence and the hard work that we've been doing behind the scenes to actually ratify what is the better candidate in the market and somebody actually that is worth, you know, paying that fee for, because you just wouldn't have access to them through any other channel, you know, i.e. putting an advert out on LinkedIn or whatever. You know, that's our value, I guess. So I hope that makes sense.
It does indeed. So let's go and talk about your opinions, right? So how is the UK market at the moment? So obviously you specialize in tech, and obviously Atom CTO, we deal in tech all the time. We've seen that the market is hotting up again in the UK. Good talent is scarce and expensive. What's your opinion on the market at the moment?
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with that. I think, you know, obviously when the proverbial hit the fan at the end of 2019 or beginning of 2020, and obviously all went into lockdown, it was a terrible market. I mean, I cut my teeth in recruitment in 2009, so I know what it's like to come into a bad market. This was nowhere near like that. Obviously, the wheels didn't come off the wagon, but it definitely slowed down substantially. So, as a first year of trading in the middle of a pandemic, it wasn't ideal. But since the thankfully the vaccination program, you know, hopefully working, touch wood, and as the announcements of everything opening back up, it feels like now all those, you know, companies that were putting the brakes on have said, right, let's go. There seems to be a lot of optimism in the market now. So there's been a real swing from a very candidate rich market about a year ago to where we are now, very job rich and candidate poor. So there's always that kind of paradigm between, you know, supply and demand between candidates and opportunities, and it certainly seems like we're in that phase now, which is always a nicer place to be, I guess, because it creates different types of headaches, i.e. talent acquisition and candidate attraction. But I'd always rather be in that situation where there's more companies hiring than nobody hiring, people being made redundant, because it's not a nice place to be for anybody, right? So I'm very optimistic about sort of where we sit now going into the remainder of 2021.
So you mentioned before that you deal with different types of developers. So you've got the full stack JavaScript, let's say, and data scientists and data engineers. Is there one particular area that is harder to find source than others, or are they all pretty bad at the moment?
I wouldn't say that any one is more difficult than the other. It literally just goes in peaks and troughs with demand. So data engineering, as an example we just mentioned there, is a particular area where that's just sort of absolutely rocketed in the last sort of 6 to 9 months. And I think principally because a lot of companies, you know, have kind of gone full steam ahead with their data science initiatives and data science strategies, and like, right, we need to build these, you know, these machine learning teams and you know, really kind of advanced analytics teams, et cetera, et cetera. But actually then probably didn't sort of take a step back and think, all right, well, actually we need to make sure our data's in the right state of play first and foremost, and sort of make sure it's all clean and prepared properly and got the right pipelines in place and all that kind of thing. So we've seen data engineering just absolutely rocket in popularity over the last 6 to 9 months for those reasons. I guess the biggest areas really where there's a struggle is just where there's continued demand from clients and it's a very saturated marketplace from a recruitment perspective. So for instance, permanent software engineers is an area where that demand never really ceases. It's kind of a consistent, which, you know, is why so many people recruit in that space. But you have to work then doubly hard to distance yourself from the noise, because you know, you could be a good permanent software engineer and have literally received 50 messages that day from recruiters, you know, emails, LinkedIn approaches, voicemails, WhatsApps, etc. And you know, you just have to work that little bit harder to stand yourself apart from the crowd and sort of, you know, distance yourself from the noise, I guess, of the rest of the you know, all the approaches. So they're the markets really that are most difficult to recruit in.
Do you think there's value in the markets at the moment? Do you think people are paid and priced correctly? I mean, obviously it's market demands, but still.
Yeah, I guess it does kind of level, you know, that's the thing. I mean, there's always that sort of sharp intake of breath when a client turns around to you and goes, what are data engineers paid these days? And they're sort of 30K out on the budget of what they thought it was going to be. But yeah, it is, you know, it's everything finds its own level, I guess. And I think I do think the pandemic is really going to, you know, I think you and I spoke about this in the past, but I do think it's really going to sort of throw the cat amongst the pigeons. And I think in many ways, obviously, look, it's not been a very nice 12 months for obvious reasons, but I think it has really changed the dynamic and really created a lot of opportunities and options now, because we've all mentally moved to this remote model that is feasible. You know, it's productive, it's working for most companies, not all obviously, but for a lot of companies. And I think once we're there, which I think where a lot of companies are now mentally, it's not too much of a distant, you know, jump to move to the next level, which is actually more cost-effective talent potentially in another country. Because, you know, what is the value of paying twice as much for a engineer in London just because they're unfortunately in a situation where their mortgage is twice as much as, you know, somebody who's an absolutely fantastic developer who lives in Serbia, for instance, who's, you know, on a similar kind of time zone. Companies, I think, very soon will be like, well, you know, sorry, Mr. London, but actually Mr. Serbia's half the price and just as good. And I think there's a lot of those kind of opportunities that are going to sort of present themselves, a lot of those sort of strategic partnerships that we're speaking to clients about at the moment, ultimately, because, you know, we're here to, you know, only find them people, but ultimately do what's right for their business. So, you know, I'll often hold my hands up and say, you know, you're probably best not to hire this person in London and actually go and find a partner, you know, that specializes in this area, because it's just going to fundamentally save you a lot of money.
Are you finding much resistance to that?
The usual kind of resistance, I guess, with some companies, where it's the whole, you know, lack of control, which I do get, of course, but yeah, when you kind of talk it through them, it's like, well, what do you see as control? Because, you know, through the last year, everybody's been working through Zoom, you know, through video calls. It would be no different if you were speaking to somebody, you know, 5 miles down the road from you, or, you know, 5 hours on a plane. There is no difference. And I think it's just when, you know, people realize that. And, you know, I guess there's always the fear of the unknown as well, right? I think I think we're getting to that sort of precipice where it's going to start moving forward. And I think, yeah, once companies have successfully brokered some partnerships, I think it will become exponential, and I think it will just be the new norm. You know, the world obviously is becoming tighter connected through the internet and digital platforms, closer and closer every day anyway. So I don't think it'll be too long till we get to that stage, but I think a lot of companies, because it's their first time actually probably partnering with a nearshore or an offshore partner, you know, there's a little bit of reticence. But equally, a lot of companies are like, actually, great idea. Yeah, it's a really good shout. And, you know, thankfully, we've been able to sort of give a few interesting introductions to clients for partners that, you know, they've never spoken to before, but, you know, seem to have a really great solution for what they need. So, yeah, interesting times ahead, definitely.
So if you're a person or a company looking to recruit, I mean, we have most of the startups, startup entrepreneurs and small business owners listening to the podcast. Now, startups are a little bit different because obviously their budgets are much lower. but and they do tend to find their own way, working people like us, of course. But if you are looking to recruit top talent, what's a good recruitment process look like? How do you stand out? Because you mentioned this previously, right? That the process now is a little bit different. You know, you just can't offer just money nowadays, I guess. You have to offer more than that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you say process, obviously there's many different facets, I guess, to a recruitment process. There's the dynamic between the agency and the candidate. There's the dynamic between the agency and the client. And there's the dynamic between the client and the candidate. So there's obviously lots of different parts at play here. And I guess like every role is different. Every company is different. Everyone's got a different culture. So, you know, there is no sort of this is a perfect process and this is how we would map it out. But I guess the key common denominator really that runs throughout all the best processes, in my opinion, is just strong communication. And that might sound like quite a fluffy answer, but it's one where everyone is pushing in the same direction. And, you know, we've had some companies that we've recruited for, and not necessarily with True North actually, but other companies I think of in the past that I've recruited for, where it's almost like recruiters are seen like the enemy, you know, kind of going back to your point that you made at the beginning on the sort of dreaded recruitment word, and they just don't work. You know, if you're kind of, both parties are setting out not on the same page, it doesn't work. So I think first and foremost, you've just got to get a really tight partnership in place where there's a real level of trust between the agency and the client. And I guess that, you know, it's difficult because it comes with time and it comes with delivery and sort of consistency, etc. But I think if you can get that, that's one big massive tick in the right direction. So to find a recruiter that you genuinely trust, that you get on with, you've got a great rapport with, you know, and you're essentially part of the same team, you know, you're all sort of pushing to get the same objective, I think that's really, really key. But I think in terms of, you know, how I would advise companies to structure their interview processes, I think at the moment, candidates aren't necessarily going to the most revered companies. It's not like they're all holding out to go, no, I don't want to work at a Facebook or a Google or a Spotify. They're going to companies that have the best processes, you know, the slickest processes, and the ones that actually have a huge amount of emphasis and importance on candidate experience. And I always say to a client, you know, be as thorough as you need to be to make sure you're getting the right candidate. You know, don't cut any corners, and don't want to put any undue pressure on you to feel like you've got to rush throughout this process and you know, not be as thorough as you want to. But in the same breath, you really need to try and keep the process as concise as possible in terms of the amount of time you leave between stages, because, you know, essentially the longer you leave between a stage, the higher the probability of you missing out on that candidate. And, you know, some very good companies which have, you know, great roles, in my opinion, really exciting opportunities, but there's just other, you know, those companies that feel they can afford to wait, a candidate to wait 2 weeks between first and second stage interview, you're just going to miss out on the candidate, you know, to a company that's got their act together and has just got a slicker process. So, yeah, that's certainly just a big common denominator of companies that are just able to consistently secure good talent. But I guess it's a balancing act as well, right? I don't want to sort of contradict myself, but obviously you do need to make it, you don't want to rush through things because you need to make it comprehensive enough that the candidate feels like, psychologically, like they've had to earn the role. You know, they've not just been given the role out of desperation of them trying to find somebody. You know, but just don't make candidates jump through multiple hoops because you think you have to. You certainly don't. So it's that kind of balancing act. And I'd say really a smooth process is initial, you know, video interview, face to face rather than telephone. It makes the world of difference, you know, to do face to face. And ideally just bring as many, I know it's sometimes a bit more of a cost, a time investment, but just bring as many of the team onto the call as possible, because that is always consistent feedback we get from, candidates as well. They enjoy interview processes where they're not just meeting the manager, they're meeting their peers and people, and they're getting a feel of the dynamic of how they communicate and, you know, how everybody interacts with each other. And that's a really, really important part of it. So I appreciate you might not want to put the whole team onto every single interview, because clearly that's a big, big time investment. But anywhere where you can show a candidate a bit more of the culture of the business, and it's difficult on Zoom, right? Obviously, it's not easy, but that certainly helps. And then it's interesting actually around the technical qualification part of the process. You know, how do you keep that as effective and efficient as possible? Because I did a poll recently on LinkedIn, and I was shocked by the results. So I asked candidates, you know, what do you feel is the way you most like to be technically qualified when you're going forward for a job? So do you want to be technically tested from home? So given an assignment where you do it from home, do you want to have a live pair programming exercise? Do you want to have verbal qualification to where people just ask you technical questions, don't necessarily ask you to code? Or do you just want to submit some GitHub code and you know, sort of wish for the best type thing? And do you want to hazard a guess at which one you think won in terms of preference?
I'd have said the GitHub code or in interview, as in
yeah. So I would have said exactly the same, but overwhelmingly, over 50% of people opted for take home assignment.
That's interesting, because
every time you speak to a candidate and you tell them it's a take home assignment, I personally feel there's just a massive backlash of, you know, it's going to take 4 hours of my day to do this.
And we've had that, right? So we've had that internally when we've been giving tests out. People have said, I don't have time for this. I've had some candidates ask to be paid to do the work, right? And what we've ended up doing is saying that, okay, you time box it for 1 hour, 2 hours, do whatever you can, and then give a presentation. So anything you don't achieve, then just present on what you would have done if you'd had the time, or alternatively, give us your code and give us your GitHub account and do that. So I'm very surprised at that, because I've had in many different countries where we've been hiring, we've had a lot of kickback, pushback because of it. And I personally think it's because people say they don't have enough time, but I think if you want a new job, you're going to make an hour or 2 hours of your time to show.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, yeah, you're right. I think if someone's really interested, they will commit to it. I guess it's difficult because if you've got four or five different processes ongoing and all of them are asking you to do a 3-4 hour assignment, it mounts up, doesn't it? And I guess at that point, that's when you've got to clarify which one you want.
It's true. But I mean, you know, have you ever heard the stories of being interviewed at Amazon and Google and Facebook, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you want to work at a decent place. You're not going to get away with saying no to someone like them, right? So I don't see why we can't have the same standard. I don't see why, you know, developers will say, oh, you're not a Google. Well, hang on. We're still producing quality work, right? Yeah. I mean, we have multiple billions, but we're still working for very, you know, decent companies. And so I think that's a thing. I don't understand. For me, in my head, I don't get the dual nature, like the, I don't know what's the word for it, but you know, the, not hypocrisy, but you know, the fact that people, you know, look at one company in one way and another company another way, right?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And actually, just, I guess part and parcel of this is, I don't know if thinking about how the data is necessarily collected, whether people like the idea in a take home assignment of 3 or 4 hours, or actually whether they just dislike the idea of somebody watching them programming on a pair programming exercise. You know, that also is a big factor, I think, that comes into it, where, you know, a lot of candidates, very good candidates in my opinion, often don't perform well in those live pair programming exercises. So you know, with sort of pressures on, so maybe it's sort of a bit of a reaction to that, who knows. But yeah, it's interesting, I guess. But I think, yeah, that approach that you outlined there, I think is very sensible. You know, you ask for a level of commitment. So obviously you insist that they assess and they like it, but you don't need to necessarily pour days and days into it. You can finish off what you haven't had time to do through a live presentation. I think that sounds pretty fair.
So obviously we're talking about recruitment, but what about retention? So, you know, obviously you were working with a lot of employers, and I'm assuming that someone will have higher churn rate than others. What are you seeing in the market? How do you keep the developers happy?
Yeah, great question. And I think this is a real myth in the market, actually. So I think it's good to kind of talk about that. The majority of managers that, you know, I speak to in the first instance, when they're losing people, very often they will blame salary. You know, say, oh, well, you know, we just don't pay people enough, you know, against the market. And obviously, you know, I want to try and challenge that in a relatively diplomatic way. But yeah, you know, certainly as a theme that we see in terms of when we're qualifying candidates, you know, we don't just sort of, I suppose, going into kind of a psychology sort of lecture here. But basically, you know, you've got the what people want, and then you've got why they want it. You know, what people want is, I want 60K. I want to have a job where I can work from home. I want to work with, you know, XYZ technology, but most importantly, really, is why people want what they want. Because if you understand that, then you understand what you're working with and what you're dealing with. And I think that a lot of people just fundamentally miss that when that people move on from companies. A lot of managers think, well, they just moved on for more money. But we very commonly, when we're sort of assessing the priorities of motivations for candidates when they're thinking of moving on from a company, it's very rarely money. You know, it's at the top of the tree. Of course, money's important. Of course, people want to be fairly remunerated for the job they're doing. But it's very rarely that you will get a candidate, you know, pick up the phone and we'll speak to them and we'll ask, you know, why are you looking to move on to pastures new? And they go, I'm not being paid enough. You know, it's usually a lot more deep seated than that. And we feel that actually there's sort of a couple of areas that, generally speaking, or why people are unhappy at their current company. And the first is just a feeling of not progressing. You know, there's no progression. And that can be career progression, but it can also be just genuinely developing as a person, you know, skills progression, learning new, just getting a different environment. And going back to the point of, you know, recruitment and why I became sort of so disenfranchised with the recruitment culture is that you're almost seen as a bit like a machine where you're just like, right, do that, keep doing it forever. And, you know, you're never given any further exposure to anything else that challenges you, or, you know, kind of it's just you're literally there making money as kind of like this entity that's expected to do it until you break. And I think it's the same thing for a lot of, probably not necessarily quite the same for a lot of software engineers and developers, but I think when they become stale, feel like not being challenged, not being given sort of a different perspective, I think that's a big reason. And the other one I think often is around sort of the culture of the company as well. Quite frankly, I think it's a really important thing for a lot of candidates that they're in a culture where they feel like they're making a difference, that they're providing a genuinely good service to the market. You know, that's a really big part of it as well. And I think in the world that we live in now, with where everyone's kind of been given a bit of a reality check of what's important in life, I think a lot of people have woken up to, you know, actually, I do want the job that I'm doing to kind of make me feel good at the end of the day, and I do want to really enjoy the work and feel like I'm kind of giving back. So I think, yeah, it's quite a lot around that as well. But yeah, they're the key areas, I guess. So if you're ever thinking about it, somebody's on the fence and looking to leave, before you sort of throw another $5,000 at them to get them to stay, often it can be take them for a virtual coffee, but maybe hopefully a coffee soon. Put your arm around them and really understand what they want out of their career and how you can help them get it. Because I think if you can get that understood, you know, I think people feel positively to the degree they feel understood. And if they feel like you understand them, then they'll probably stick around.
So there's a drawing to a close towards the end of this podcast now. And there's a couple of topics or a couple of things I just want to touch on with you. I know you're quite involved with diversity in the tech scene. So how have you seen diversity improve? Have you seen it improve, firstly? And, you know, what's the future? Are you seeing more women, minorities, et cetera, coming through into the talent pool?
Yes, is the sort of short answer to that. Yes, we are seeing more coming through, which is great. Yes, there is more attention being paid to diversity and inclusion as an overall policy, rather now than sort of lip service of like, oh, we've got to have a D&I policy, and it's this thing HR do that actually doesn't really permeate into the business at all. So I think we're definitely seeing more of that, but it's still slow, right? There's a long way to go, because the inherent culture is so entrenched in so many businesses that it's not something that's going to change overnight. It's going to be a long time before we get to this point where I think there's true diversity and inclusion and kind of a fair level playing field for all. But you can only really do your bit, right? Obviously, you can't sort of sit here and moan about other people not doing theirs. You just got to be the change that you want to see in the world. And that's what we do, you know. And I'll be really honest with you, you know, my emphasis on diversity, I wish I could say it came from a highly altruistic place and I'm this great person for having a real focus on diversity. But in all honesty, the reason that we decided to focus on diversity is, and helping women in tech is that I'm dad of two daughters, and it kind of really hit home to me. You know, I was starting to have conversations with software engineers. It's just actually, what kind of world do I want my kids to be brought up in, and I want them to be given the same opportunity as others as well. And it's just something that kind of really stuck with me, and I think, like I said, you just got to do your bit and help wherever you can, and sort of even at the playing field, and hopefully set a good example for others, you know, to do the same.
So what are you seeing as a difference in the generations? So obviously, you know, I'm 40s. So if you're going to recruit me, it'll be a very different situation than trying to recruit someone in their 20s. So what is the difference nowadays? I mean, how should, if someone's out there, well, I don't know what generation we're called now, but anyway, and it's someone in their 40s looking to recruit, you know, what should they be doing to try and attract that younger talent?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, there's always talk, isn't there, about millennials, and often seen in quite a disparaging light. That millennials don't want to work hard, and at the end of the day, look, well, call it what you want, it's the next generation of the workforce, right? So whatever it is, we've got to work out how to engage that next generation of the workforce. And I think what it is, you know, we live the majority of our lives in a place where we haven't necessarily had kind of a digital first world where, you know, hard work and perseverance and all of those traits that, you know, are not necessarily us, but, you know, a lot of people attribute millennials to not having, were genuinely needed, you know, and it's the only way you can kind of really stand yourself apart from probably the next person that sat next to you in the desk. Whereas, you know, the world of work that we live in now, the internet has fundamentally absolutely changed the world to, you know, an unrecognizable place. From where we're, you know, it's been around 40 years, right? So a blip in the sort of landscape of human existence. But what it's done in terms of how it's transformed the world of work over the last 40 years is just unrivaled, and it's only getting exponentially further that way. So these kind of millennials, or whatever you want to call them, this sort of next generation of people coming through, have, you know, they are more tech literate, which again is a great trait, you know, because they've kind of been brought up in that sort of world. But they're brought up in a world where, yeah, there is more convenience, and they've got more choice, because, you know, they're living in a world where they're open to choice, because, you know, quite frankly, they're like, well, if I don't like this, I can go and do this. Mm. And that's not a bad thing, I don't think, you know. I think people finding their right vein and their right niche in life is way more important than somebody actually doing something for a long period of time that they don't enjoy. And I think there's so many people have wasted their careers and wasted their lives sort of just doing a job because they think they have to do that job without actually really ever, you know, and personally speaking on a pretty philosophical level, I think that's actually the important thing. That's what we're put on this planet to do, is work out the one thing that we really enjoy doing, that we're really good at, that we, you know, enjoy serving other people, and do that one thing. And that's kind of, I'm not really going to be one of those dads that kind of lectures their kids, but that's the kind of one bit of career advice I'm gonna bestow upon my kids when they grow up, is, you know, do something you enjoy as a job that you would do if you weren't getting paid to do it, you choose to do, but just do something that serves other people. And by nature of doing those two things, I think, you know, you'll get very good at something you enjoy doing, because you enjoy doing it. It's not being seen as a chore. And, you know, if you're serving other people, you're solving other people's problems, and there's value in that. And so I think that's kind of the way that a lot of millennials do think. And I don't think it's a bad thing at all. So, you know, to answer your question in a roundabout way, what can people do? I think it's just don't judge people, you know, when you kind of book and cover type scenario. And I think it's just, you know, if it isn't the right role for somebody and they're not in the right place, then don't try and flog a dead horse. Go and find somebody that is, because, you know, more than enough people out there that probably will be better.
All right, so we've reached the end of the podcast, and it's shameless plug time now. So let's talk about True North. How do people get in contact with you? What's the process? How do you deal with new customers and new candidates?
Well, I mean, always happy to hear from new customers and new candidates. We are a good place at the moment. We're probably busy now as we've been since the business has been launched, which is fantastic, because I suppose all of those sort of seeds that we've been sowing over the last year or so starting to come through to fruition, which is great. Of course, always happy to hear from further prospective candidates and further prospective clients. And in terms of, yeah, getting in touch, you know, I'm contactable on LinkedIn. So always happy to receive an email or a connection request on LinkedIn. So just search Guy Bevington. I think there's only two of us on LinkedIn. I think the other guy's in construction. So hopefully you won't get us too mixed up. And yeah, obviously head to the website if you fancy checking us out, which is truenorthgroup.io. You can always pop a message over there, and yeah, love to have a chat and go for a coffee. That's what I enjoy doing.
You have your own podcast as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess going back to the point I was making earlier about building communities and leading with value. We place a huge amount of importance on standing apart from the crowd in terms of actually building brand within the business, but also encouraging every consultant in the business to build their own personal brand as well. I think that's absolutely key. And we do podcasts, specifically the Python People podcast, which, you know, Python, I guess, is the primary language that connects a lot of the markets that we recruit for. So hence the name. And I thought the alliteration sounded quite good as well. So that's where it came from. But if you fancy checking out any of those episodes, then they're all hosted on Spotify. If you search for the Python People podcast or Guy Bevington, it will come up, and listen away.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, guys. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you, Rav. Thanks so much for your time. And take care. Speak soon.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you like what you hear, then please subscribe with the Atom Ventures podcast. And you can find us on Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all the great podcasting sites. Please also leave a review. And if you want to get in contact, then please visit our site, atomcto.com. You can find us on LinkedIn under Atom Ventures and Atom CTO. And you can email us at info@atomcto.com.